KALW.
COVID became a serious thing, killed millions of people. I didn't want to be one of those millions, and I didn't want you to be either.
It's been more than 2 years since the COVID outbreak hit San Quentin State Prison, one of the most deadly in the entire prison system.
So I go to the cell front, he said, "You tested positive for COVID." And then he locks the door. For him to tell me that I had COVID and then lock the door, like, it had an immediate effect on me, right? I went straight to fear and panic.
Today, we're going back in time to hear what it was like on the inside.
I remember giving you my kids' phone numbers. If I end up leaving, if you get a chance to get on the phone, call and let them know that I ended up going to the hospital.
The first episode in a brand new season of Uncuffed is coming up. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today's show is brought to you from Uncuffed, the KALW podcast recorded and produced inside California's prisons. It's sometimes hard to think back to what it was like at the beginning of the pandemic. It's been more than 2 years now, and after constant news about vaccinations and new variants, those early days feel like a lifetime ago. But for incarcerated people at San Quentin State Prison, they'll never forget those first few devastating months. In June 2020, the state transferred infected inmates to San Quentin Prison. It quickly caused one of the biggest COVID-19 outbreaks in a California prison. There was a lack of PPE. Social distancing was near impossible. People were locked in their cells for 24 hours a day or housed in makeshift medical units in tents on the yard. No visitors. No programming. In that first outbreak, 2,000 incarcerated people were infected, and 29 died. Today, on this brand new season of Uncuffed, we'll hear a firsthand account of what it was like during that time.
Welcome back to Uncuffed. This is Tan Tran, your favorite host you have never heard of, and for those who don't know, Uncuffed is a show made by people in California state prisons. And today, we're in San Quentin, sunny San Quentin, California. And in the room with us right now, we got a couple of the fellas. Go ahead, shout out, man, to the left.
I'm Greg Eskridge.
What's up, everyone? This is Edmund.
Hello, it's Tommy Shakur Ross.
Tommy Shakur Ross, the phenom himself.
Yes, yes.
And we're here for a special, special reason today. Greg, why are we here today, man?
Man, this is Edmund's first piece, man. You know,
snap it up for Edmund, man.
Yeah, Edmund finally get his voice out there. Well, his voice has been out there, but he finally getting his first story, man. Congratulations, Edmund.
I appreciate congratulations. You in the room right now. Thank you so much.
That's right.
I just want to say, man, this story was really good, but you look really good right now in this room, man.
He is shining.
There you go, man. Stop flirting with me on my.
So go ahead, tell us a little bit about this story, because I know we might be laughing right now, but this is a very serious piece because this is going to bring us back to 2020, right when the pandemic kicked off.
Right.
And we were slammed in the cell for like a week at a time, coming out to barely ever shower. And this is when people were dying left and right in San Quentin.
Yeah.
So this is a very serious story and it's a very serious moment. So go ahead, Evan, tell us what the story is about.
For sure. I totally agree with you. This is a moment in 2020 that I didn't want to forget because it was so important. And I feel only one side of it was told. And this gives us the opportunity to tell it from our perspective. So during this time period, like you said, we were locked down 24 hours a day. If we were lucky, we were getting one shower a week. And if you tested positive for COVID-19, you were taken out of your cell, you were marched down to the yard and housed in these makeshift tents.
Tent City. That's what we called it.
That was the nickname, Tent City. And I was down there with Scott, one of the characters, subjects in the piece. And he decided to go on a hunger strike. And in asking him why, he told me that his cellie had went to the hospital. He doesn't know what's going on with him, hasn't heard anything from him. And a couple of his close friends passed away. Mm. So after the year-long lockdown that we were on, and we finally got the chance to come down to the studio, I brought Scott and his cellie Oz to have a conversation. Scott, in the piece, is the younger guy, and Oz, his cellie, is the older one. So this is a piece about one man's reaction to another man's circumstance.
Absolutely, absolutely. During this time of not only suffering, being on lockdown, you're stuck in this tiny 4x9 cell with another human being. I'm gonna just say it like this: you're gonna get to know this person really, really well. This guy is gonna be your night and day. You're gonna figure out every single thing about this person. So let me not ruin the story. Let's just go ahead and play. How about that? How's that sound?
Let's get into it. Let's go.
Yep. All right.
I remember the day you showed up at my cell, and of course, you know, everybody stresses out, and it's like, oh, we're gonna get a cellie. I turned around, and there you are standing, looking at me like, are you Oz? Yep. And you just said, I'm your cellie. I was like, okay, and I look up, and I see this, chia pet hair, and the smile was like, wow, okay, you know, this guy looks pretty cool, and he speaks English, so that's all I speak. And he's skinny, so I can get around him in the cell. So rack up, dude. You know where to go. We started going along after that first week. Day for day after that, it was just like peanut butter and jelly, man.
When the coronavirus hit, you know, we knew that it was in the United States. And we'd realized that if it got into San Quentin, that it would move like wildfire. You know, the first thing I thought is I don't have any complications, and, you know, I'm only 40 years old, and I wasn't real concerned about myself, but I was immediately really concerned for you. So, do you remember how you felt when we first learned there were cases in the prison?
Scared like hell. I'm suffering from the loss of a lung from being a volunteer fireman for many, many years. I've had heart surgeries, list goes on. But my main concern was, yeah, if this thing hits, and I know it's considered respiratory, but it was also affecting people's hearts. Before that, I remember we both kind of had fevers, and we slept a little bit longer in the day, and we were like, yeah. And I remember one day we were like high-fiving, going, yeah, we both got over this, you know, we made it through it. Remember that?
I think you were more optimistic than I was.
I was.
I think you kept saying, I think we're through it. I think it's going to be over now. And I kept being like, bro, we got COVID. And you're like, nah, we're just...
It's flu.
It's just the flu. You're like, think positive.
I was scared. That's the way I play off my... COVID became a serious thing. Killed millions of people. And you know, hindsight, but I didn't want to be one of those millions. And I didn't want you to be either. I remember giving you my kids' phone numbers.
Yeah.
Telling them, if I end up leaving, if you get a chance to get on the phone, call and let them know that I ended up going to the hospital.
Yeah. And I knew that you didn't want to go to hospital at all. You didn't want to, you know, because going to the hospital means risking the loss of our property.
Yes.
You know, risking potentially not having a good cellie anymore.
Yeah.
You know, these are things that, you know, you get uprooted, especially with how many guys were going to the hospital and that they were quarantining people in other units. Nobody wanted to go. Nobody wanted to go. Guys were willing to just sit it out until they were dying.
But that day when I finally turned to you and I said, look, man, I got to go man down, man. I can't breathe. I can't catch my breath.
Man down, 410.
Man down, 410.
Man down, 410.
Man down, 410.
Man down's what we yell when we're having a medical crisis in ourselves and we need the guards to come get us.
I knew when I got to, when the CO came back to escort me down, he said he had to take me all the way to TTA, where we go for 3 hours. And
the hospital.
The hospital, yes. Hospital. Yeah, prison hospital. And on the way there, I kept stopping every 60 to 80 feet, and I kept stopping, and I take deep breaths, and I'm thinking to myself, there's two things going on right now. One, am I going to ever come back? Is this going to kill me? Am I ever going to see my kids again? Because all I have left are my children. You know, all my wife, my parents are all passed away. So, and I'm thinking to myself, man, this is the last thing I need. Then I get into the hospital here, and the nurse puts the monitor on, and she runs over to the phone and starts dialing the phone, and she's asking for an ambulance stat, and I'm like, what the hell's going on here? And she turns around and she says, you know, you're having a heart attack right now. We need to get you out of here.
After you left, it was just all morning. There was alarms. Dudes leaving up out of there, alarms, and it was crazy. I was hoping, you know, Oz will be back in a couple days. Don't think negatively. And a couple days went by. And then I started being like, damn, wow, he's been gone 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. At that point, I think I really started thinking I wasn't going to see you again. I started thinking about other guys, a number of other men in other housing units in the prison that, you know, older, have serious health complications. There was a lot of talk around the camp about what to do. There were a number of other guys there that were really worried about their cellmates and friends and whatnot. And we're just genuinely, I think everybody felt like that our lives had been risked frivolously. I just was furious. And so I wanted to do something, and all I could think of is hunger striking. So it was getting more serious, and some of the officers really understood when I was hunger striking. Some of them were quite sympathetic. They said, we get it. Like, we understand, you know, why you're upset. We're furious too.
Yeah, I remember finally my final day when I was a week and a half in intensive care. They finally said, we're going to send you home. When I came back, I was kind of excited coming back home. You know, this is our home now. This is where my property is. This is where my friend is, my cellie, you know, you. And when you saw my smiling face, and I actually walked in and gave you a big hug and said, man, I miss you, Doug.
Yeah.
I miss you.
Yeah.
And let me tell you about what happened, you know? And that's when I knew that there was actually light at the end of the tunnel. And knowing that it wasn't completely over yet, because even the side effects, the adverse reactions it did to my body, as you can tell as I talk now, I have this like a velvety voice.
Right.
That's COVID related.
You know, you mentioned long-term effects and, like, you know, I mean, shoot, the short-term effects were crazy. I remember that first month was really intense, though. I was honestly scared that COVID had basically altered your mind forever. It was really an emotional process for me because, like, I got Oz back kind of. Like, what the f*** did COVID do to my friend? It was really heartbreaking to see a man who I knew as so brilliant have a difficulty in understanding the fundamental mechanics of just like how to leave the cell and get to the hospital and, you know, make it to a ducat on time. And it was heartbreaking. And, you know, the fact that you have recovered an enormous amount of your, yeah. But, you know.
Yeah, that was an experience too that I'll definitely never forget. The COVID outbreak in San Quentin.
Yeah.
Never forget it.
I'm happy that I was able to actually get this story finished and completed. I'm glad we have the opportunity to talk about today.
So absolutely, Edmund, man, I'm excited. I'm glad that you got this story. I just want to say for myself, when I heard this story for the first time, I felt re-traumatized. Yeah. So I want to hear some of y'all thoughts, man.
Yeah, this is Greg, man. Evan, I just want to say it was a great story. It was very relatable, and it was actually a sad story, but it was also empowering. Mm. And when I say empowering, because the fact that you got these two people, these two individuals who are living together, and one person is going through a tragic situation, and his celly is like super supportive of him, you know, because just like you said earlier, that celly dynamic can be kind of up and down, you know, they can be kind of, you know, some people have like kind of tough experiences. But to hear these two dudes talk, man, you could just hear the love. Mm-hmm. You could just hear that concern, just hear that compassion, fighting, you know, just fighting for his celly, like in any kind of way he could. You know, that was just beautiful to hear, bro. You know, that was just beautiful to hear, man. It was just real touching, real touching. I see you over there, Shakur, nodding your head.
Yeah, man. I wanted to just commend you for putting that story out, because it does provide a window into what was really going on in June 2020, when the pandemic hit. And so, like, when you talk about the tents and all the things that it mentioned, like with the man down, like, I really think that you were able to capture the essence of what we were experiencing during that tumultuous time. Yes.
Shout out to Scott, because, man, it is an act of bravery to go on a hunger strike in prison, man. I think there was just so much going on already, like in regards to being locked down, like for days at a time, like showering once a week. Like, man, I literally got out. There was a period when I got out the cell once a week to shower, right? And the rest of it, staring at a ceiling. I'm just laying in bed, staring at a ceiling. And for him to be experiencing this heavy isolation and trauma and be like, you know what? I still got the will to fight. Shout out to Scott, man. Shout out to Scott. Nah, you are sure, a better man, person than sure. me.
Shout out to Scott. I remember just being down in the tents with him. We both have COVID. We both feel miserable. I can barely keep my food down. And he's in the other cot across the room from me. Mm. I just see him just like slowly falling apart. And one morning I just got up, went over there, had a conversation with him. Like, this is a new disease that we don't know anything about.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, I understand that you want to stand in solidarity with all the guys that are passing away that you and also care for, but you can't do that if you pass too. Yes, you are fighting for us, but also give your body the opportunity to fight for itself by eating and getting the basic nutrients that it needs. Mm. Long story short, he took my advice. A couple of days later, he was like, you know what, I'm going to stop hunger striking. I'm going to take care of myself. Can we do some yoga on the yard? You know what I'm saying? I was like, all right, bro, I got you. We could do some yoga. That's we could stretch some. We can try to get back in shape.
About how long did it last, the hunger strike?
If I remember correctly, it was like 3-4 days, not eating anything. He was just over there on his bunk with his little radio on, listening to NPR all day.
Mm. Hey, but that's crazy, because Scott is already just like barely 140 pounds as it is, and you go on a hunger strike, man. I know his stomach was like shooting through his back. I mean, but it was he was in a situation like, man, like, what else can I do? Yeah, like, I want to be able to do something to just show like I care. Like, you know, I mean, his hands was cuffed, and that's commendable, though. You know, that's commendable.
I most definitely respect it.
Even though when you do go on hunger strikes in prison, you know, it does come with some disciplinary actions sometimes taken. You know, you can end up with write-ups and get sent to the hole for that, you know. But fortunately, he didn't have to go through all that. But, you know, hey, man, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do. This was a traumatic time.
Absolutely.
Nah, most definitely. This is Edmund. But I remember, like, before I even went to the tents, just hearing man downs every day. My cellie's 56 years old. He's an asthmatic. If he catches COVID, like, what is the potential that I can lose my cellie? And that would just play in my head every day. I would make sure that he would get up, drink water, take care of himself, not just lay in the bed all day. Like, I love having my celly. I have too much energy to be in a cell by myself. Like, like, I have to be talking to somebody. So, like, one of the things that me and my celly did on this pandemic was every day, Monday through Friday at 7 o'clock, we would watch Jeopardy. That was like how we bonded. And man, you ain't about to get this answer. And surprisingly, my celly is like a Jeopardy guru. Like, how do you know all these answers?
Sign him up.
I've been living and I got an experience, youngster. So I couldn't picture this horrible experience without my celly. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? That's how much I love and respect him.
Ace, a trip just to hear that man down phrase. I hear Scott in Edmund's piece, you hear him saying that man down. And I know that's traditionally, you know, what we do when, you know, when somebody's in the cell and somebody falls out in the cell, goes down, and then everybody starts to scream, right? And so I just trip off how that really brings everybody together inside of the building. Like, for one moment, like, everybody's together. As soon as you hear somebody say, man down, the next you know, you hear hundreds of people start screaming to get the officer's attention so all the medical people can come and make sure this dude gets aid, right? So it's just a trip, just like how, like the care,
yeah,
you know, that concern that we all have for each other when somebody is falling ill. Yeah. And I just I've always tripped off that, but I don't think I tripped off of it as much as I did back during the outbreak, because it was so many going on. Mm. And so everybody was like falling out like 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day.
Yeah.
And you sit in the cell like damn, it was scary. Cause now it's like, man, like,
yeah, that was wild.
Am I next? Yeah, who was it? You know,
I've never experienced nothing like that.
Yeah. And then to hear somebody go, because you normally hear a person go man down, and then somebody, oh, his back went out or something like that. Yeah. But here, we were hearing man downs, and then a dude leave, and then he don't come back.
Hey, I got to tell y'all, like, because I actually caught COVID, right? Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because it was during the first wave when nobody had it. So, you know, because initially, like I think we had even done, we had talked about COVID prior to us going on that pandemic. Mm-hmm. So we was talking about, you know, how we would fist bump and kick feet and coming up with different ways. But I know I didn't understand the seriousness of it. But the officer, my tier officer, came to my cell and I'm laying on my bunk. I'm on the top bunk. And he says, Ross, report to the cell front. So I'm like, okay. So I go to the cell front. He said, you tested positive for COVID. And then he locks the door, you know, that lock. And when they lock the door, psychologically, because they already have the bar pulled, so you can't get out the cell unless they release the bar. But when they turn the key in the lock, just psychologically, for him to tell me that I had COVID and then lock the door, like, it had an immediate effect on me, right? Oh, wow. I went straight to fear and panic, right? Yeah. I just wanted to run. I just wanted to just get out of the cell, but I couldn't get out of the cell. Mm. And then I remembered my tools. I start breathing.
Yeah.
I start taking deep breaths, right? Then I start to calm down. And I said, this too will pass in my mind. Yeah. And then after that, I was cool. But it was a trip though, man, just initially for the officer just to tell me that I had COVID and lock the door.
That was an excerpt from Uncuffed, the podcast produced inside San Quentin and Solano State Prisons. Our work in prisons is supported by the California Arts Council and the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. The producers fact-check content to the best of their ability. Content is approved by an information officer. Hear more by subscribing to Uncuffed in any podcast player or visiting kalw.org. Today's team includes Monica Gomez, Hanisha Harjani, Gabe Graben, James Rollins, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adil, Lisa Morehouse, Shia Levitt, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Suni Khalid.